accession number 20970, Real 5.
Real 5.
Well, like I said, this was the first proper cooked food for months that we had had. Sometimes we went by some vehicle. Like, for example, we would come across a railway line and there would be some trains standing there. And somebody said, let's try, maybe it will go somewhere. And we would climb on the train and it would go in the wrong direction or it wouldn't go at all. Other times we just walked along. We found bits of food, and like I said, sometimes fresh bread was given by the Russians. The Russian army was was moving in the opposite direction from us. We headed in the general direction. I mean, there were no maps, but you could see from the sun which way to go. And suddenly we fetched up in Bratislava. Now, that was interesting. This is a major city. This is now the city, the capital city of Slovakia. At that time, it was just a major city. It was damaged like all other cities, but there were some perfectly good buildings standing, including a cinema where we found a place to camp. And this is another of the mysteries of this period. In the same cinema were a number of Dutch people. These were families, mostly women and children, but there were a few men. We could make ourselves understood to some extent because we spoke German and some of them spoke German, or others who didn't spoke Dutch, and the two are close enough for simple conversation. But I don't know why they were there. Who were they? They were clearly refugees of sorts, but they were not Jewish. They didn't have much, but what they had, they shared with us. And also an interesting incident occurred. My aunt, the musician, came across another musician on the streets of Bratislava. I think she was Slovak, this other person. They spoke German to each other. And this Slovak woman invited my aunt to her home, which was impoverished and she didn't have much to eat and so on. But she had a piano and they made music together, and a few of us from the family, we could join, and suddenly heard music. And this was a great occasion. But there were various incidents. You see, it wasn't very easy to make this journey. Mostly the night times were hard because of the temperature as well. It was very cold. The March time, the snow was still on the ground. We were very cold. When we traveled, I remember once, for example, traveling on a train which must have carried vehicles. This is just an open platform with a few bars on the sides where they might have secured the vehicles before. And it was all right when we climbed onto the train in the afternoon. But when we woke up in the train in the small hours of the morning, it was the dew was on us, frozen. So it was not a comfortable journey, but we had a purpose, and we finally climbed off one of these exactly trains like I just described to you. We climbed off it at a place which turned out to be a Hungarian town, a small town, and not even very near the border. So we must have made good progress on that occasion. So we climbed off the train and we heard the first Hungarian words spoken to us by somebody other than ourselves, and these were, "Bloody Jews, could you not have rotten where you were? Why did you come back?" These were the first words spoken to us in the city of Gödöllő. I recently had the occasion, it's now a major university city. There is a university mostly specializing in agriculture, but they have other courses there too. And I had the occasion to visit, and I should have visited, but I declined. I had no particular wish. But I don't think that it's specific to Gödöllő. It might have been almost any other city. Well, I'm sure I might have incidents here and there about this period of my life to tell you, but for the minute let me continue. Gödöllő is not far from Budapest. We went in search of our home, and we found that it was inhabited by a family, Hungarian family, who had been bombed out. And they had nowhere to go. They didn't dispute our possession of this home of ours, but we were in no position to argue, and they were in no position to go anywhere. We must have been calculating. Them and us, we must have been about 8 or 9 to a room, because ours was a big family and theirs was a very large family. And then the numbers began to increase further, because people returned in their ones and twos, members of our family, and they went in search of their own homes or their loved ones. And so they fetched up in our home, and because they had nowhere else to go, so they stayed. The closest members of my family, other than the ones that we shared these experiences with, they had lived very near us in the same area of Budapest. And had we been unable to join my grandmother in Debrecen, we would have been together with them. She was a cousin of my mother's, like a sister to her. I loved them, her and her mother and her son. They were very close to us. They were all shot into the Danube. And there is no doubt that we would have been together, and this would have happened to us. So when it became clear that this wasn't the place where we shall continue living, then my cousin, my mother's cousin, the one with the little boy who had been ill, they turned up. And it was their idea that there is a suburb of Budapest, a northern suburb called Újpest, where there were lots of homes to be had. My mother's cousin's mother herself used to live there. She perished in the war, but she used to live there somewhere. And so it was conceived of a notion that we try to find a home in Budapest, in the suburb of Budapest called Újpest. True enough, there were lots of homes to be had there, because there had been 20,000 Jews living in Újpest before the war, and almost all of them perished in Auschwitz. And so their homes were standing there empty. Somebody gave us an address. We went to the town hall, law-abiding citizen. Somebody gave us an address. We went to this address. It was a very dirty, but very beautiful, by my way of thinking and my way of remembering, beautiful home. We cleaned it, and we were about to settle down in it, when a member of the family returned from the forced labor camps, and they said it was theirs. We shrugged our shoulders, we were used to it, we went back to the town hall, we were given another address. That was a worse home. It was inconvenient for many ways. It had once been a cloister. The walls were thick, the ceilings were high. There was no bathroom, although there was running water. There was a huge studio. It had been the home of a painter. And there were about five or so rooms. A few days later, the council came and said, we are to have only two rooms and the other rooms are to belong to somebody else. So we shrugged our shoulders. And we proceeded, of course, to clean this place too. The worst part of it was a bathtub. Although there was a toilet, the Russians didn't use the toilet. The Russian soldiers who stayed in this place, they used the bathtub instead. And the bathtub had stood in the middle of the living room. But we cleaned the bathtub and so on. And there was no bathroom, but there was a bathtub. There were bigger mysteries in the war than that. This was just a minor matter. So this is then the place where we lived until I got married. I got married when I was 19, but that will come a bit later. We had injections for typhoid, which was necessary because the dead bodies of people and animals were lying about everywhere. We got very feverish and very ill. Because of the jabs that we got. There was no food to be had worth speaking of until somebody said that there is a soup kitchen somewhere set up in a restaurant, what used to be a restaurant, a kind of a pub restaurant. So I went with the famous blue pot with the handle to bring home some hot soup. I was standing in a queue and I was looking over the fence of a house neighboring to the restaurant where the soup kitchen was. There was a terrace of this handsome house and there was a lady playing with her dog. And I cannot tell you what it made me feel. I mean, that was so far from anything that I had experienced for so long before, that there could be such peace, such normality, as someone playing with a, there was a ball and the dog was jumping and barking happily and the lady was playing with her dog. And after a while, the lady came down from her terrace and she was the one who distributed the hot soup to me. And when I said that there were 11 members of her of my family, she actually gave me 11 full ladlefuls, and I was grateful to her. She later became my mother-in-law. What I didn't realize was that she wasn't playing with her dog with such an easy heart, because she lost her son, one of her sons, already. But somehow, you know, irrational as it is, I could never forgive her this little incident, that she had a life where my mother and my grandmother and my baby cousin and so on, we hadn't, and she had a life. Anyway, while we still lived in Budapest, before we moved to Újpest, I got to a school. This was the secondary school attached to my primary school, where they wouldn't have me in the first place, because I was Jewish, there was something left of the school year, and my family and I, we were keen that I shouldn't miss a year, and I had about 6 weeks to make up for the curriculum of the whole year, and I was given some books and some instructions and so on, and there was a girl who was a good student, and she was asked to give me some advice and help so that I can take the exam, and I did. So I passed my exam for the first year of the grammar school in 1945. And then we went to Újpest, and then, of course, I was enrolled to the local grammar school. On one side of the square was the girls' grammar school, and on the other side of the square was the boys' grammar school, except the girls' grammar school had been bomb damaged. So for a while we went to the boys' grammar school in the afternoon, and the boys went to their own grammar school in the morning. I was the only Jewish girl in my class. It turned out there was one Jewish girl in the class below and one in the class above. And as we were cavorting around the school yard, this was a school for 8 classes from the age of 11 until 18. We were walking about, the three of us. How did we know each other? I don't know. Two of the grown-up girls came along, and they introduced themselves, and they said, their names were Eva and Gerti, Wolkenstein Gerti, and I forget now the name of Eva, although I know her married name. She became the wife of the rabbi who officiated at our wedding. Anyhow, the two of them said, in case you should have any trouble, this is our classroom and you can fetch us out at any time. And we said, what trouble? And they said, oh, you will see. And sure enough, we did. In a suburb, anti-Semitism is always much fiercer than in the more cosmopolitan central part of the city. And they did make my life very difficult. My life was difficult for two reasons at school. One was because I was Jewish, and the other was because I was good at my schoolwork. I was good at my schoolwork even in the other class, where there were lots of other girls who were academic and clever and interested, even in my primary school. But here, the atmosphere was different, the standard was lower, the girls' interests were elsewhere, and I was without any companionship in my class. There was only one girl later on who was similarly inclined, and even that friendship, potential friendship, was spoiled by the form mistress, and I shall have to tell you because this was important. I was isolated because I had other interests, as well as because I was Jewish. The mistress in charge of needlework was a Nazi. I didn't know. And she persecuted me to the point that my family intervened, and the headmaster of the school, Sipos was his name, he taught us French. He was a charming, gentle, well-educated, cultured man who didn't know how to cope with the situation. He himself was decency itself, but he didn't know how to protect me. The woman apparently did her. I wasn't her only victim, but in my class I was. And finally, months after, Shiposh and she came to our house and apologized to my parents for the way she behaved towards me. Not to me. The events had to be reported to me by my father. But she came. Istvanfi, Mrs. Istvanfi was her name. I nearly forgot. Nothing I did was right. And I tried harder and it was still not right. And I had to kneel in the corner of the classroom. I had to have my fingers bunched together to be beaten with a strap, and so on. There was one particular embroidery we had to do. It was a cushion cover, and when it was given to me, then she said, she gave us each one of these to do, but the one she gave me was more labor intensive than the others, and she gave a deadline. And I've tried to say, but there's no way I can finish it by that time. And she said, just try and see what happens if you don't. Well, my mother's sister, one of my mother's sisters, not the one who is the musician, but the other, she went to art college, and she was a superb needlewoman, as was my grandmother. And so they set to work, and they completed this for me, and it was beyond any quality of work that a child of 12 could have made. And the woman made me unpick a good part of it because it wasn't good enough. But this is just a small incident. I actually beat up a girl at one point. By then we were about 14. Because I was tired of her forever calling me names, filthy Jew, smelly Jew, bloody Jew. Actually beat her. And we were both punished. And I think rightly. There was a girl in the class who was jolly. She did me no harm. And she was bright enough, but she was not academic, and she had difficulties with her work. She is now a renowned actress. Chala is her surname. And she's well known in Hungary. I saw her in a comic play recently. And she needed some coaching for schoolwork. The system is that you have to pass year by year the exams, otherwise you can't progress to the next year. And to be held back a class is quite a shame on the family. That's the system. Well, so I was to earn my first earnings. It was fantastic because I could coach the Chala girl. And I had to go to her house after school and spend there a certain amount of time and did the homework with her and so on. And on one occasion, I arrived and she wouldn't let me through the door. And she said, no, I'm busy today and I don't want us to have our lesson. And I said, well, all right. And then I heard from inside the house the voice of that one girl who was academic, who was my friend, not Jewish, Annie Koltai. I heard her voice saying to the Chala girl, well, come on, I haven't all day, let's get on with this. Well, it turned out that the form mistress decided that Annie was more in need of the money, or she was not Jewish, or who knows. So she said, it was she who set up my coaching of the Chala girl in the first instance, and she must have decided otherwise, but without telling me. And I could not forgive her, the form mistress, and somehow it undid the friendship which began between Annie and myself. But we had other company. You see, this city of 20,000 Jews had fragments of families still left over. When we first arrived, that was near the Jewish festivals. The Jewish New Year and the Day of Atonement, they occur in the autumn. And we arrived in Újpest in the late summer. And so we went to the synagogue in the autumn because it was a place to go, not because we were religious. It was just a place to go. And the synagogue was all but empty. My mother, men and women are kept apart in Jewish synagogues, more observant, stricter Jewish synagogues. And my mother was approached by two other women, and they said they also had girls, and we got to know each other somewhat. And then somebody turned up, just a child left over from a huge family. My father met him through his business. My father opened up a business. He was the world's worst businessman. He opened up a business selling parts of machinery. And he went from house to house asking, do you need any machine parts? And so he knocked on this factory, which was a wood yard, a timber yard, which made out of timber furniture parts, whatever. And a boy came, and a boy of 14, my father said, can I speak to the owner of this factory? And he said, well, I suppose I must be the owner. It used to be my father's factory, but you see, my father is not here anymore, and my grandfather's factory used to be that one, and my uncle here. Well, he was the sole survivor of a family of five brothers and a grandfather, all of whom were in connected with the wood business. And my father said to him, but who cooks for you? Where do you live? And he says, I sleep in the entrance hall of our old house, but the rest of the house is lit by somebody. Who cooks for you? Nobody. So he came to have food with us. And he ate with us for several months, and he became a friend. My mother-in-law ran a hostel, practically, of returning victims of forced labor camps. They knew that they could go to her house and sleep there for a while. And some of these were staying behind, and they became part of our circle of friends. Our circle of friends finally became about 18 or 20 people, the youngest being 11, the girl in the first year of my grammar school. And the oldest was my husband and his two contemporaries, who were 17 at the time, nearly finishing grammar school. And this was an interesting mixture. Hungarian Jewish society was quite stratified. Before the war, we would never have all got together. There was one boy whose father owned a stall on the market. And there was enough snobbishness. He would never have got into the group that we belonged to. And my closest friend was the daughter of a very wealthy family. she and her family came to live in England, and they became owners of factories in Cumberland and so on. They became wealthy here too because they managed to get some of their wealth over. So we would have been somewhere in the middle between the working class Jews and the really wealthy Jews of the city. But as it was,